Hey everyone, I wanted to give you a heads up that the highly anticipated second season of the hit podcast Proof is finally here. So if you're looking for more true crime content, go check it out because Proof is an awesome investigative true crime podcast co-hosted by Susan Simpson of Undisclosed and Jacinda Davis of Evil Lives Here. Proof made headlines for its first season in 2022 after proving the innocence of two Georgia men serving life sentences for murdering their friend, Brian Bowling, when they were just 17 years old. And 25 years later, on December 8th of 2022, both men were finally freed, all based on evidence unearthed by Proof. Now in the second season of Proof, Murder at the Warehouse, Susan and Jacinda are on the case again, this time traveling to the streets of Manteca, California to uncover who really murdered 18-year-old Renee Ramos. On June 5th of 2000, Ramos's body was found buried under a pile of debris inside the shell of a new Home Depot building. Despite tips hinting at alternate suspects, tips that were ignored until now, Renee's boyfriend, 18-year-old skateboarder Jake Silva, and Ty Lopez, the 33-year-old uncle of one of Jake's close friends, were arrested and convicted of her murder. Fans of true crime and investigative series won't want to miss this riveting new season and follow the case as Susan and Jacinda uncover long overlooked evidence about what really happened to Renee by listening to Proof, Murder at the Warehouse, wherever you get your podcast. Hey guys, I'd like to introduce you to a new podcast that I know you're going to love. Do you like travel? Do you like picturesque locations and getting away from it all? Well, this new podcast has all that and murder. It's called Slaycation and it's a darkly humorous look at murders and mysterious deaths that took place on vacation. Hosted by a true crime fanatic, her comedy writer husband and his TV producing partner, Slaycation brings a unique perspective to chilling, thrilling, and WTF stories of vacations gone horribly wrong. From the twisted tale of Harold and Tony Henthorne, whose romantic anniversary in the Rocky Mountains ended with one of them falling off a cliff, to Angelica and Vincent, two recently engaged lovebirds whose Hudson Valley kayaking adventure ended underwater. Each episode of Slaycation will have you asking, accident or murder? But it's not just the stories that'll intrigue you. It's the discussion between a longtime married couple and business partners who happen to be Emmy-nominated TV producers. Each episode of Slaycation also includes humor, takeaway and travel tips that will keep your next vacation from being your last. If you're ready to pack your body bags, Slaycation is available on all major podcast platforms. Search for Slaycation on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Sometimes in this world, people disappear without leaving a single trace behind as to what happened to them. And these stories are scary, strange, and tormenting to the family and friends left behind, who have to constantly think about the possibilities as to what went down. And these cases on this list are very weird. You have to hear them to believe them, so here are five mysterious vanishings from the past. Number 5, the Millbrook Twins. When it comes to crimes, it's no surprise that depending on where they happen, race and status can play a huge role in whether or not investigators work hard to solve them. While missing affluent children often get nationwide attention, missing kids from poorer, small-town USA are often overlooked and even ignored. Which was the case for 15-year-old twins Danette and Jeanette Millbrook, who vanished into thin air one day 34 years ago in Augusta, Georgia. On Sunday, March 18th of 1990, the Millbrook family attended church service that morning and stopped to pick up some chicken for lunch on the way home. When they got home, Jeanette told her mother Mary that she had seen that they were being followed by a white van. Mary could tell her daughter wasn't playing around and looked out the window to check, but there were no vehicles in sight. Later that afternoon, the girls left the house to go to their godfather's place to get bus money for the following week's fare to and from school. After that, they went to visit their cousin and their older sister. And then, they stopped by a gas station to buy chips and a soda. That was the last time anyone ever saw them again. Mary grew concerned by nightfall when her daughters still hadn't returned from their outing. She headed out to go look for them on foot with her 12-year-old daughter, Shanta. Together they searched the streets, and after a few hours of coming up empty-handed, Mary called the police. On the other end of the line, though, there was no swift jump into action. In fact, the police seemed unconcerned about the whole situation, telling the frantic mother that she had to wait 24 hours to report a missing person. When Mary called again, a detective told her bluntly, they probably ran away. And since then, while the family's done everything in their power to find the twins, the authorities only gave a half-hearted effort in trying to locate them. They never treated it as though a crime had occurred, just two teens who decided to leave home. Even though the disappearance of these sisters was the only unresolved case of twins disappearing in America, no one seemed all that interested in it. And it's well believed that it's because this occurred down south, and the girls were black and from a low-income family. In 1993, someone called the police and informed them that the girls had in fact been found. This unknown caller was never identified, but that single anonymous call caused the case to be dropped from the system, even though it was just a phone call from a nobody. For 10 long years, no one but the family continued in the search. In 2013, the case was reopened when a new Richmond County Sheriff was elected. However, all trails had since gone cold by that time. It had been 23 years already. It seemed that the girls had simply vanished into thin air, and the case remains unsolved to this day. Though, it's more than likely someone picked them up at that gas station or on their walk home. Perhaps someone in a white van is the only person who knows the truth. Number 4. Catherine Eggleston. In the early 90s, Portland, Oregon was a city much like any other in the U.S. It was a nice artistic community, its streets bustling, and back then it was a relatively safe place, especially considering it was a city. However, a dark mystery was about to happen that would leave a scar on the town, and it's the story of Catherine Eggleston, who suddenly, and under weird circumstances, just disappeared. 22-year-old Catherine, recent Oregon State University graduate, is known for always flashing a bright smile and her kind-hearted nature. And she was working in sales at AllNet Communications Services, so she reported to an office building each and every day, and that was her routine. On August 2nd of 1993, she had a meeting to go to in Portland. Her company was based just outside in Lake Oswego. She had to run some errands along the way, and interestingly, this was the first time she was headed out alone on any business-related ventures. She must have been feeling proud, knowing they trusted her to do that. She made a bank deposit for the company, got some gas, and grabbed lunch at a Burger King. All this was verified by witnesses that day. By the early afternoon, she had made her way to the Port of Portland building, where her meeting was. And again, there were witnesses who saw her in the lobby making some phone calls. At around 2 p.m., the man she was supposed to meet with went down to the lobby to wait for her, and watched from across the room as she exited the elevator with a man wearing a blue blazer who had dark hair and a dark complexion. Instead of walking towards him, they just walked out the front door. And nobody has seen Catherine since. She missed an appointment with her advisor that day that was supposed to happen at 5 p.m. back at the Lake Oswego office. That night, she didn't return home to the place she shared with her sister. Her sister called her dad, and by the following morning, he had driven out there. As the calls went out by the authorities, people were told to be on the lookout for Catherine and or her gray Volkswagen Golf. And that's when a security guard of an industrial complex located near the airport found her car parked there, and this was 9 miles away from the Port of Portland building. Her car windows were down, and the car was unlocked with the keys still in the ignition. Catherine's purse was in there with some cash, her checkbook, ID, and credit cards. However, her passport, which she had grabbed from her parents' house just 10 days prior, was missing. On the afternoon that she disappeared, those witnesses who saw her in the lobby said she seemed anxious and nervous while making her calls. So, what was she up to? More importantly, who was she talking with? Had she secretly run away with this dark-skinned man to forge a different life, or was something much darker taking place? Her company then paid for a large-scale search operation. Bloodhounds and volunteers scoured the area around her car, all the fields and buildings, but nothing was ever found. A hotline was set up where tips poured in, but it was hard to tell who was legit and who wasn't. I mean, one person called in saying they had killed the young woman and that they'd never find the body. In 2004, in Corvallis, a woman named Brooke Wilberger disappeared and was later discovered to have been murdered. Her killer was caught. A man named Joel Courtney had done it, and apparently he had been in the Portland area around the time of Catherine's disappearance. He was looked at as a suspect for some time, though nothing concrete ever came from that. While Catherine's parents believed she was 100% murdered, lead detective Terry Wagner seemed to think that she left on her own accord, and she had good reason to think that. Her own sister was under investigation for tax fraud. She had apparently not claimed $190,000 her business had made, and so Catherine, since she lived with her, was going to have to testify against her own blood. And maybe she knew her sister was guilty, so rather than face the music, she decided to get out of Dodge. Something happened to her, that's for sure. Seems strange to run away forever just because your sister needed to pay some taxes, but then again, stranger things have occurred. To this day, though, nobody knows exactly where she is or what happened to Catherine Eggleston. Number 3, June Carpenter Gilkerson. On the morning of November 8th of 1986, down in Midland, Texas, 24-year-old June Carpenter Gilkerson said goodbye to her husband and headed out to work at the Midland Restitution Center, which was a halfway house. She was there volunteering, learning the ropes of what it took to become a probation officer because that was what she aspired to be one day. Only, she never made it there, and in fact, has not been seen since. But that doesn't mean we don't know what happened to her. You see, June had a secret she was keeping from her husband. For around the past 6 months, she had been having relations with a man named David Alderink, who was on probation for burglary, so their paths crossed over at the halfway house. 2 days after she disappeared, her car would be found at a Best Western motel with all her stuff in there. Purse, the keys, and some of her clothes, but no sign of June herself. And typically, with any missing person, the spouse is the first one to suspect. Her husband was looked into, of course, but he had an alibi and was very distraught about his missing wife. And he still loved her, and he didn't know anything about the affair. A little more digging, though, by detectives, and they found out about her extramarital relationship with the ex-con David. And that's when they pressed him. Hard. Until he broke. Part of his probation was to perform community service, and he did his at the local library. It was there that he met the janitor, Kenneth Parker, and once the two got to talking, Parker told him about his get-rich-quick scheme. He explained that he could sell American women to the Mexican cartels and, in exchange, make $10,000 per woman. And even though June had told David she wanted to divorce her husband and move in with him, the feeling wasn't exactly mutual. David told Parker he could get him June, and they agreed to do a drop-off. In exchange, David would get $7,500. So, on the morning she disappeared, they planned to meet up before work. Once June arrived, Parker came out and grabbed her. He put duct tape around her mouth and threw in a sleeping bag and took her away. That's when David drove her car to the Best Western and left it there. But June didn't want to play nice, and she put up a big fight against Parker, who would go on to tell David that there was no money to be had because he needed to take her out. He said he shot her, and then he took her body to a relative's house where he burned it in a pile of tires. While Parker, to this day, still claims he's innocent, and June's body has never been found, the police did find Parker's gun with two spent casings, which was enough to seal his fate. And David, because he cooperated, would go on to be sentenced to 20 years in jail, while Parker was given two life sentences and will be eligible for parole in the year 2048 when he is 100 years old. Number 2, Kyle Klingscales. Kyle Klingscales of LaGrange, Georgia, was the sort of young man most would describe as full of potential. A student at Auburn University in Alabama, he was a sports enthusiast and was on the cusp of deciding what direction to take his life in. But on a cold night back in January of 1976, the 22-year-old set out on a journey from his part-time job at a bar in LaGrange, headed out to his school. It was a drive he never completed. That night, the mystery began, and it marked the start of a quest for answers coming from his parents, Louise and John. Where did he go? What happened? And most importantly, was he still alive? Their entire lives would soon be consumed by a series of unsuccessful search missions. Drained lakes and thousands of bumper stickers and flyers with their son's face would be put out over the years in search to end the mystery, but still nothing. The Klingscales' house showed a relentless spirit of hope. Among the many family portraits, there was also a permanent place setting at the dinner table for the young man. A spare key was left in their hiding spot in case he ever made it home. As the years turned into decades, the tormenting question of what happened to Kyle Klingscales remained unanswered. That is, until almost 46 years had passed by. In December of 2021, an unexpected discovery was made. A motorist traveling on a two-lane road in Cusset, Alabama, noticed the rear end of a rusted vehicle protruding from a creek. They told authorities, who pulled it up, and inside the waterlogged 1974 Ford Pinto lay an ID belonging to Kyle and his skeletal remains. Without warning, the town's coldest case was revived, and although grim, provided a semblance of closure to the mystery that had gripped LaGrange for nearly half a century. The tragic irony was that this closure came too late for Louise and John, who had passed away in 2021 and 2007 respectively. Yet, the community was there to remember, to mourn, and to finally lay Kyle to rest. It was an accident that occurred on a remote road and hidden all those years were the answers that tortured his parents until the day they died. Number 1, Susan Walsh. Susan Walsh, a 36-year-old journalist, mother, and part-time exotic dancer, stepped out to make a phone call outside her home in Nutley, New Jersey, and was never seen again. And because of the type of work she did, there are many possible suspects, but still no concrete answers. Susan was estranged from her husband, and he lived in the apartment below them so he could be a part of their son, David's, life. And Susan worked hard for her family, and while pursuing a master's degree, she held a few jobs just to keep a roof over their head. She published articles in the Village Voice and Screw magazine, and while being a full-time writer was what she aspired to be, the freelance journalism world didn't always pay the bills. As a result, she worked various jobs as a stripper, but that also fueled her desire to expose the dark corners of society. As Susan wrote about the seedy underbelly of these types of clubs in New York and New Jersey, about how the Russian mafia had their hand in bringing over young girls and getting them involved with this type of work and providing company to men willing to pay. She also wrote about the underground vampire culture in New York, going to clubs and learning about their dark rituals herself. Her work was groundbreaking, edging on the dangerous, a tightrope walk between revealing the truth and becoming a target. On July 16th of 1996, Susan made a phone call to her estranged husband downstairs, stating she would be stepping out to use a payphone nearby, and she never returned. The mystery of her disappearance began as a simple missing person case, but soon unraveled into a complex web of theories and dead ends. Despite exhaustive searches and widespread media coverage, no trace of Susan has ever been found. She had vanished into thin air, leaving behind her young son, in a series of investigative reports that some believe may have led to her untimely disappearance. The investigation into Susan's disappearance opened the door to a labyrinth of the possible underworld connections, including ties to organized crime and the secretive communities she infiltrated during her reporting. And just 2 days prior to her vanishing, she was actually filmed for a documentary about women working in the adult industry, where she mentioned that it's dangerous and that she herself had a stalker. Now, her ex-husband Mark was not considered a suspect, though it was revealed that he refused to let police into his house to do forensics testing, and that stalker, apparently Susan, had told a friend that it was a former boyfriend. The article she wrote about vampires was never officially published, so it doesn't seem it had anything to do with that. The Russian mafia certainly could have made a play, but if that's the case, good luck finding and catching them. And then there's the reality that friends were concerned that Susan had relapsed into drugs after 11 years of sobriety, so maybe there's something to that angle. In the end, there's a lot of possibilities. Maybe it was something random that happened, or maybe, after all those years looking into the dark corners of society, someone didn't like what she was saying and did something about it. So there were 5 mysterious disappearances from the past. I'm Andrew, and I want to thank you all very much for tuning in. If you like listening to us and want to get an additional and exclusive podcast each and every week, go check us out on Patreon, where now you can get the audio-exclusive podcast for just 75 cents per episode, plus access to the entire library. That link is down below. You guys stay safe out there. I'll see you very soon.